Galatians 5, please. We're on in Galatians 5. We're going to be picking up in verse 16 here. Galatians 5 and verse 16. Good to see each one of you. Good to have the Gowans back after an extended absence. Hopefully they're back to stay for a while. But they've been down in Foley for a few weeks. As we come into this section of Galatians, we are moving out of what one might term as the doctrinal part of the epistle and moving into the practical. I mean, certainly there's still doctrine being taught here, but as is typical with Paul's letters, he will have this the first section as being, you know, here's the teaching, here's the doctrine, here's the truths that I'm presenting, and then he'll move into, well, how does that affect us in our everyday life kind of a thing, the practical side of things. And this Galatians is no exception to that. But as we move into this, let me show you how he segues into this section and why this passage on the spirit and the flesh and the fruit of the spirit and the works of the flesh. What does this have to do with the main subject of the book? I mean, how does this fit in? Should be a question that we ask ourselves as we study, because he doesn't just, this is not completely divorced from the main issue that caused him to write the letter in the first place. And what is that main issue? What has happened with the churches in Galatia that instigated this letter by Paul? Okay, the Galatian brethren that are predominantly Gentiles are being persuaded, Lisa says, to turn to Judaism. What are they doing? That was Judaism? Is that the example of Judaism for us? They are being persuaded by what has been termed Judaizing teachers, Christians that are Jews, in other words. These are not unbelieving Jews. These are Christians that are Jewish by heritage, but are mistaken about the place of the law now that Christ has come. And they are trying to tell these new Christians, these formerly pagans, these Gentiles, that not only Christ, but the law. You have to keep the law of Moses as well. And so that's the main issue that Paul is having to teach against. And I said we're going to pick up in verse 16, but we need to back up to see the segue. So take a look at the end of verse 11 and 12. He's talking about the influence, the people that are persuading them. Verse 8, this persuasion does not come from him who calls you. It talks about the leaven in verse 9, the influence that these people are having upon them. And in verse 12, he uses some very graphic language to say, I could wish that those who trouble you would even cut themselves off. Play on words there with the cutting of circumcision. And he uses the word that literally means to mutilate or to emasculate themselves. And as I said last Sunday, he's not wanting that to literally happen. But this is so detrimental to them that he wants this gone. And they need to be removed. They need to be cut off. And then he says in verse 13, For you, brethren, have been called to liberty. Only do not use liberty as an opportunity for the flesh, but through love serve one another. For all the law is fulfilled in one word. Even in this, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. But if you bite and devour one another, beware lest you be consumed by one another. This issue was not something that was just that apparently when you take a look at these verses and the verses following that we're going to be getting into with the works of the flesh and so forth, what apparently was going on was not just some civil discussion about this. Apparently, things were tending to be quite heated, and there were some problems with the way they were treating one another, and he's warning against that. Turn over to Acts 15 just very briefly and look at the way that Luke describes a similar discussion there. Acts 15. Now, I believe the timing of Galatians, the letter to the Galatians in Acts 15, is that the Galatian letter comes first, like really soon before Acts 15. Otherwise, why didn't he just refer to what they talk about in Acts 15? Why doesn't he just refer to the letter that they draft? Because it's the same issue. It's the same problem. And he could have solved a whole lot, written Galatians a whole lot shorter and done the same thing by just saying, look, we've already hashed this out. Here's the letter that we wrote. Okay, but so I think Acts 15 comes afterwards. And this takes place in Jerusalem. Actually, it starts in Antioch, though. Paul and Barnabas and others are in Antioch. And verse 1, it says, certain men came down from Judea and taught the brethren, unless you are circumcised, according to the custom of Moses, you cannot be saved. Therefore, when Paul and Barnabas had no small dissension and dispute with them. That's Luke's way of saying it was a big dissension. No small dissension. It was a big discussion. This is a major thing. So no small dissension and dispute with them. So this is stirring up a lot of emotions, and this is stirring up a lot of debate. And there's apparently, going back to Galatians now, there's apparently at least a tendency to let this go into a type of discussion that is not a fruit of the Spirit, that is not godly in its characteristic. Because he immediately starts talking about loving one another and don't be biting and devouring one another and consuming one another. And then he moves into the discussion about the Spirit and the flesh. Okay? Everybody see that? I want y'all to see the transition that Paul is making here as we move into this section. Okay. Any questions or comments before we move on into verse 16 following? Okay, so it's on the heels of that he says, I say then, walk in the Spirit, and you shall not fulfill the lust of the flesh. Now let me pause. Earlier in the epistle, remember I had a chart and I was showing this from Galatians 3. Paul used those same terms, spirit and flesh. But in that context, what did flesh have to do with? What was he comparing? When we think of flesh in the Bible in a negative way, we're usually thinking of it in what way? Let me start with that question. Sin. It's something associated with sin, sinful desires, the lust of the flesh, right? And I think that that's what he's going to be talking about here in these verses. But in Galatians 3... what did flesh represent there? Well, that would be the spirit part of it. That would be the spirit contrast. But somebody else said something? The law, okay. And specifically what aspect of the law, which is the major issue of the letter? Circumcision. But that's literally fleshly ritual, right? In Galatians 3 and in verse 3, are you so foolish, having begun in the Spirit, are you now being made perfect by the flesh? He's not talking about sinful desires. He's talking about this act that is a literal, physical, fleshly act. Is that what's making you perfect? Is that what's making you justified before God? Is that what is making you part of God's family? Is that how you're justified? And so this entire chapter, flesh is used to describe just literal fleshly things, whether it be the act of circumcision or whether it be Ishmael being born of the flesh versus Isaac being born of the Spirit. Okay, so that's the contrast there. But here in our text this morning in Galatians 5, when he says, walk in the Spirit and you shall not fulfill the lust of the flesh, as we're going to see, he's not talking about circumcision at this point. He's not talking about some fleshly act. He's talking about those sinful desires. Verse 17, for the flesh lusts against the Spirit, and the Spirit against the flesh, and these are contrary to one another, so that you do not do the things that you wish. But if you are led by the Spirit, you are not under the law. Let me make sure we understand this, because this is that verse, as well as verse 13, and backing up to verse 1 as well. In verse 1 and verse 13, what word is common to those verses?
Liberty.
The idea of freedom, right? And then here in this verse that we just read in verse 18, saying you're not under the law, those verses have been misused and abused in religious groups today to say, you know, we're no longer underneath any kind of law. We're not underneath some kind of law system. And almost as if Jesus came to take away any kind of rules. And there are many that buck at the idea of, oh, we have rules we have to follow as a Christian. Is that what Paul is talking about when he talks about the law and the liberty from the law, the freedom from the law? What is he talking about throughout this entire letter? Yeah, it's the law of Moses. Context is everything when studying the Scriptures. And the law, just about every single time that Paul talks about the law in Galatians and in Romans, he's talking about the law of Moses and how we're no longer underneath that law. That doesn't mean that we don't have law to keep, but we're not underneath the old law anymore. So we're under we're to be led by the Spirit, not by law, not by the law of Moses, and certainly not by the flesh. And then he goes into what we call this listing of the works of the flesh. Let's just briefly read verse 19 through 21. Now the works of the flesh are evident, which are adultery, fornication, uncleanness, lewdness, idolatry, sorcery, hatred, contentions, jealousies, outbursts of wrath, selfish ambitions, dissensions, heresies, envy, murders, drunkenness, revelries, and the like, of which I tell you beforehand, just as I also told you in time past, that those who practice such things will not inherit the kingdom of God. Question for you. Can you think of things that could be included in this list that Paul did not include, that you would say are definitely a work of the flesh? These are broad enough, are they not, that they can cover a lot of things? But, I mean, are there things? Did he leave some things out, though? I mean, did he list every single thing?
You may read the standard version.
I'm going to ask for some of that in just a moment. So, yeah, hold on one second to that.
Well, when he says and the like, I think that covers everything.
Yeah, and the and the like are these things, are things that are like to these. You know, he understands. He's not listing by name every single sinful action of the flesh. But I think that there is a reason why he chooses the ones that he does. Now, I was reading in the New King James, and the New King James starts with the word adultery. That word is not found in the other text. Probably is a scribal insertion. The word that is there in all the text, though, is translated by the New King James, fornication. What other words are there instead of fornication?
Sexual immorality.
Okay, sexual immorality. Anybody have another term there, that very first term in that list, besides fornication or sexual immorality? Okay, that's the Greek word porneia, from which we derive our term pornography from. And it is a broad term that is just any sexually deviant behavior. It's all inclusive of sexually deviant behavior. The New King James translates it fornication, and sometimes we tend to think that fornication is limited to two people that are not married to anybody, like premarital sexual relations. But really, it's just a broad term that has to do with any sexual immorality, which is why it's translated that way sometimes. Look at that, the first group of works of the flesh here. You've got the sexual immorality, uncleanness in the New King James, lewdness, idolatry, and sorcery. Now, which group of people in the ancient Near East in the first century would that describe? Think about it. The Jews, they divided everything into two groups. It was Jews and Gentiles. Which would that describe more likely than the other? The Gentiles, right? That's just how they would be characterized. That was their lifestyle, and that's the way the Jews would look at them and say, yeah, that's the way the world acts. And can we be guilty of the same thing? That we look at the world and was like, yeah, look at them. They're guilty of all the sexual morality and they're just the uncleanness, this whole state of mind and being, of not being pure, lewdness. What's another word for lewdness? Do you have
sensuality?
Idolatry, of course. That's a pagan thing. And sorcery. Corey, did you know that you're a practicer of sorcery? The Greek word there is pharmacia. You are a pharmacist, right? Yes. So we have a sorcerer in our midst. That's where we get our word pharmacy from. Because sorcery in that time, there was apparently some use of drugs in their divination and the things that they did. Obviously, that's not what Corey's doing. Does anybody be concerned that we have a sorceress in our mix? No. But that is where we get the word from. And so those things are characteristic of pagans, of Gentiles. But what about the next group? Hatred, contentions, jealousies, outburst of wrath, selfish ambitions, dissensions, heresies, and envy. Who does that describe? Everybody, right? Now think about the context. Think about why Paul's writing this letter and what's going on. You can see why he would start off with some of these more well-known lusts of the flesh, that they would, especially the Jews, gladly point the finger at somebody else and say, yep, that's those Gentiles for you. But then he lists all of these things that, oh, wait a minute, that just might include me. And especially in light of what's going on with this, with these dissensions and disputes and these arguments that's going on, and the jealousy and trying to persuade. I mean, this is not just they're not just using persuasive talk and techniques, getting up and standing and giving a debate or anything, trying to convince somebody. I mean, there's some sinful things that can be taking place, either that they are engaging in or they're in danger of engaging in. And so I think there's a reason why Paul specifically points these out. When we think about the lust of the flesh, at least for me, I don't know if you feel the same way or not, but when I think about lust of the flesh and sinful desires, usually what comes to my mind are things more along the first few items, and actually drop down to the end of this list, and the last two, drunkenness and revelries. Those also, or orgies is the other word that's used there. We'll talk about those in just a moment, but when I think about lust of the flesh and those sinful things that the world participates in, it's this kind of stuff that I typically think about. Do y'all kind of do that too? Is that the thing that first pops into your mind? And what we here's the lesson for us today, the application for us today, that it's not just that. We may be arrogant in our thinking and say, well, Yeah, I don't do this, I don't do that. Y'all remember the song, was it by Adam Ant, Goody Two Shoes? Was that the? Okay. Don't drink, don't smoke, don't do this and don't do that. And we think, we pat ourselves on the back and say, see, I don't participate in all those things. Well, what about the hatred and the contentions and the jealousies and the outbursts of wrath and the selfish ambitions and the dissensions and the heresies and the envy? Do we conveniently leave those out of our list of the lust of the flesh? And yet, I think this is really what's driving the list. I think this is what Paul is zeroing in on more than anything else is, there may have been some there that were, certainly if they were former pagans, they probably were involved in, at one point, the adultery or the fornication, the uncleanness and lewdness, and certainly the idolatry and so forth. But Paul's saying there's more to it than that, guys. It's not just that. It's also how you treat one another. And so I think he's tying this in to what he was saying in verses 13, 14, and 15 about, yeah, you're not under the law, but that doesn't mean you can just be free with your flesh and do whatever you want, but you need to, through love, verse 13, serve one another. And it refers to the greatest command, as Jesus termed it, the second greatest command, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. And the law is fulfilled in that one statement. Not devouring one another and so forth. This is an excellent reminder for when there are disagreements. I mean, certainly ideal that, and it's the wish of Jesus and of Paul, 1 Corinthians 1, that we all get along, we all have unity, Ephesians 4, we're striving for that unity, the bond of peace, and that we are working towards that fellowship. But are there going to be some disagreements along the way? Are there things that you believe that maybe I don't believe, or vice versa? I mean, I know you're wrong and I'm right, but in any case, there's going to be those disagreements. How do we handle that? Okay, well, we need to consider these passages. And these are what need to influence how we handle those situations. Questions or comments about any of that? I went to preaching there for a moment.
Paul, I forgot what your word is, but he says wrath and fits of anger. This is what we get into.
Outbursts of wrath.
Yeah, outbursts of wrath and rivals. Well, it becomes a rival because you have your side of the opinion, I have mine. Yeah. And I go over and I talk so, and you do the same. And any of us who've been around the church for years, that's what we see happens. You give me people your side of the heart, as you can, and I do the same, vice versa. Then we try to outnumber each other. This is what causes the split.
Yeah.
Because they like me or like Mark, but yours are vice versa. And that's what Paul's dealing with here. These divisions cause that division, that rivalry.
Yeah.
He's saying love's greater. You just read the book, Paul and Mark's got a disagreement. How they handled it, discussed it. The church group would know. Paul and Barnes had a disagreement over who? John Luke.
John Mark, yeah.
John Mark. Mark's willing to take it. Barnabas recognized the Bible as a son of encouragement because of how he treated people. It says they had no small dispute over that.
Right.
But later on, what do we see? Paul and Barnabas got along. That strong disagreement that they had, they worked it out. That was the last sermon.
Yeah. For those of you who couldn't hear what David was saying, I'll quickly summarize one of his points because I think there's something there I want to play off of. In this situation, you have the Judaizing teachers and their arguments versus you have those of the circumcision and those not of the circumcision, and whether or not circumcision and the law was necessary, even for the Gentiles. And you've got these people who believe strongly on both sides of the equation. And when you have that, and he said one of the dangers is where you're going around and you're drumming up support, and you got this side and this side, and you know, next thing you know, you can split the congregation. I will give you a example, an absurd, true example. I may get some of the details wrong, but I can't remember even who told me this, but this is supposedly a true example of a church who could not get along and split because one part of the church wanted to put on a tin roof on the building and the other part of the church did not. Can you believe that? Unfortunately, yes, we can, to a degree. That's absurd. There's a solution. 10 on one side of the roof. Those who like the 10 roof can sit on that side, and shingles on the other side. Yeah, yeah, that's
right. I heard one similar to that. The color of the trash or the color of the carpet when it was in the building.
Yeah. I mean, you talk about majoring in minors. And not focused on spiritual matters, and then not behaving themselves according to what he, I mean, this is works of the flesh. Now, granted, what they're discussing in Galatians is of a lot more significance than the roof or the color of the carpet. But that doesn't change the way you handle it. And so you've got these two sides. And each side thinks they're right, and my opinion is right, like I said a while ago. I mean, after all, I think it, so it must be right. What's the problem that exists in those situations? When you have contention or hatred, contentions, jealousies, outbursts of wrath, selfish ambitions, dissensions, heresies, and envy, how would you sum up what's at the root of all of that? Okay, Lisa says selfishness.
Wanting your own way.
Selfishness. Okay, that's what it should be. Love should be the priority. Pride. Yeah, pride and selfishness. I mean, that's all part of the same thing, right? And we've got to be willing to understand that, you know, sometimes differences of opinion, sometimes it is just opinion, but in any discussion, what should be the ultimate goal? Should it be, here's an obvious question or an obvious answer. I'm going to give you the two choices. It's going to be easy to pick the right answer. Should it be to win the argument or to come to the truth?
Truth.
Both of you can do it. What?
Resolution.
Yeah. But that's based upon the truth. That's what you should be after. Not whether or not you win the argument, whether or not it's what you want, it's what the truth is. And yeah. Lisa says, if they can't agree on a roof or a carpet, how can they agree on more important stuff? Well, there's obviously a lot wrong under the surface that needs to be corrected because they're not going to agree on the more important stuff. They're not striving for the fellowship. It is one of the biggest detriments to our name and our reputation is splitting, all the dissensions and so forth. It is a blight. It is a sin. And it should not happen. It is a work of the flesh. Moving on in the list in verse 21, the New King James has envy and then murders. That's another word that is probably not in the original list, but certainly, I mean, that would be one that is a work of the flesh. But the other translations don't have murders. Drunkenness and revelries. New King James uses revelries. ESV or New American Standard, one of those uses the word orgies. I know that that's a graphic word. And you know, when we think of that word today, we think of just this big party where all inhibitions are gone and you know sexual immorality is rampant. And while that would maybe be part of the case in the original usage of that word, it is just a wild letting go party of various kinds. not necessarily referencing sexual activity, but it could include that. But if I'm not mistaken, the Greek word there has to do with Bacchus, the god of wine. And it's the word that we get our word debauchery from. And so it's just this party atmosphere, you know, where the alcohol is flowing and anything goes kind of a thing. So those two plus the first few certainly characterize what the Jew would see in the Gentile world, in the pagan world. But right smack dab in the middle is all of these terms, all these lusts of the flesh, works of the flesh, that anybody could be guilty of, and especially in their situation, they could be guilty of. And so just admonition to us is, let's not be so cocky and think, well, that because we don't participate in sexual immorality or idolatry or sorcery, except for Corey, or drunkenness or so forth, that we're okay and we're good to go. Now, there's plenty of other things in here that we can be just as guilty of that are characterized as works of the flesh. And what is the result of those who practice these things? What does he say?
Will not inherit
the kingdom of God. That's how serious this is. Okay. All right, questions or comments on these? All right, so contrasted to that in verse 22 and following is the fruit of the Spirit. If you have the Spirit, and we had a whole six-month class on the Spirit, I'm not going to rehash all that, but do not immediately associate with this the miraculous acts of the gifts of the Holy Spirit. You know, the Spirit is there for all of us. All of us have the Holy Spirit. And like Romans 8 talks about, in fact, Romans 7 and Romans 8 is very similar to what we're reading here. Romans 7 is being led by the flesh. Romans 8 is being led by the Spirit. Well, that's what he's doing here in this letter as well. He's talking about the works of the flesh and being and the fruit of the Spirit. It's what things would be characteristic of someone who is God's child, someone who has been given all the blessings of the Holy Spirit. Well, that would include love, joy, peace, long-suffering, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Against such there is no law. Now, do you see how this also plays into his overall point and what's going on? These are the opposites of the hatred and contentions and jealousies and outbursts of wrath and selfish ambitions and dissensions and heresies and envy. And how you deal with one another and that relationship you have with your brother. It's love and joy and peace and long-suffering and kindness and goodness and faithfulness and gentleness and self-control. That's really a characteristic of someone who is led by the Spirit. And there is no law against those things. He says, verse 24, those who are Christ have crucified the flesh with its passions and desires. If we live in the Spirit, let us also walk in the Spirit. Let us not become conceited, provoking one another, envying one another. And it's those final two verses there that really lead me to, that help me and lead me to believe as well that the focus of this entire section is the issue that is driving this there with these brethren where they're fighting amongst themselves. And so he ends with, and he comes back to the being conceited and provoking one another and envying one another. These are very real possibilities when you have two groups of strong differing opinions about something or understandings about something. Let me just say that. It's not just opinions, it's understanding in this case. What they're dealing with is not just a matter of opinion that God doesn't care one way or the other about. You know, this is doctrine and this is gospel. And some have the wrong understanding. So the fruit of the Spirit is one that's going to approach that situation with love and peace and long-suffering and so forth. I've said it many times. Many of you know this about me. It's not a character trait that I like. It's something that I have to fight against all the time. But I have the personality to where I am so competitive, and because I want to be right all the time, and because I think my way is the best way, that I can be abrasive, and I can be domineering at times, and I can be conceited in that as well. And if any of you have those same type of traits, then you know what I'm talking about when I say just how difficult it is to crucify, as he says here, to crucify the lust of the flesh. To crucify the flesh with its passions and desires. That is hard for me. And everybody's going to have something. I mean, that may not be your thing. But you may have some other part of the flesh and its desires that you've got to crucify. And Paul uses that term very specifically. He chooses that word to paint the picture of what it takes, okay, to crucify. I mean, we talk about crucifixion and the cross so much that maybe sometimes we just lose the impact of what all that meant. Go back to chapter 2 of Galatians. In verse 20, he says, I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me, and the life which I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. That's the idea. We've got to get rid of ourself, put that completely to death. When we become a Christian, Romans 6, Paul talks about this. In baptism, what are we doing? What's the imagery that he uses in Romans 6?
Putting away the old man.
Okay, and not just setting it aside, though, not just putting it away, but what? But crucifying, killing that old man, right? Putting it to death, burying that old man in baptism, and raising up as a completely new creature. Question. Did all your sinful desires, did your lust of the flesh, when you became a Christian, when you supposedly crucified that man on the cross, did they stay buried?
No.
That's the problem, right? That old man wants to come back up out of that grave, doesn't he? He wants to resurrect himself and come back into your life. And it's a constant crucifixion. There's a one-time death that we enact when we're baptized, yes, but there's an ongoing daily crucifixion that he's talking about here. All right, chapter 6, read that for next Sunday, please.